Okay, we've gotten started a little bit into Revelation chapter 17, and we want to go ahead and read verses 1 and 2 again tonight as we start, and we'll ask Brother Dave Watkins to read that for us, Revelation chapter 17, verses 1 and 2.
And there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, I will show thee unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters. But then the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication.
Okay, so we concluded chapter 16 last week, looking at that, that contained the covered the pouring out of the seven last plagues. There were seven angels that each one had one of those plagues, and all of that was found in chapter 16. And it's one of those seven angels that came to John here in verse 1 and spoke with him and told him to come to him. And he was going to show John the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters. And then we are we're going to be told, as we read a bit further, down in verse 5, that a woman had on her forehead the name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. So that's what's written on the forehead of this woman. So here's this Babylon the Great, and she's going to be judged by God. This woman is one, it says in verse 2, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So God is now going to judge this Babylon. Well, with the pouring out of the wrath of God and with that seventh angel at the end of Revelation chapter 16, that when that seventh vial was poured out, in verse 19 it says the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. And then it says, and great Babylon came in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. So we were already told there at the very end that God is now remembering this Babylon. So it is time for God to judge this great Babylon. And we can see how this Babylon was the source of much wickedness. That not just within herself, but this city was the source of wickedness for so many places. So this was the root or the seat of evil here in this time that he's speaking about, and God is going to destroy by judgment this city. All right. Well, if we turn over to the book of Hebrews and look at verse 4. This is a principle that we have from God about his judgment. Hebrews 13 and verse 4. Let's see, Brother Tom, can you read that?
Marriage is honorable in all, and the bed undefiled. But whoremongers and adulterers, God will judge.
And that's a fact of the matter. And this is an example of that. That we have coming here. So here's the judgment of God against this mother of harlots and this great whore that sits upon many waters, this city that is the source of so much wickedness. Well, he refers to it as Babylon. We already saw that reference back in chapter 14 when there was this angel that was... that John saw there flying in heaven, that was saying in verse 8 of Revelation 14, Babylon has fallen, that great city. because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. So we've already seen this before. That was when it really got introduced, and so this is, it's come up again in chapter 16, and here it is again in chapter 17, and now it's really the focus of chapter 17. So why does God refer to this city as Babylon? Is this actual Babylon? The physical city? No, and it can't be, and how do we know that? It's gone. I mean, it was gone at the time of the writing of this book of Revelation, and in the roughly 2,000 years since Revelation was written to now, what has changed about that? Nothing. It's more weathered, I imagine, and probably whatever the ruins there are in that location, there's probably, over the course of that time, I think it's safe to say there's probably been more decay or whatever there, but it was in ruins at the time in the first century AD as it is now here in the 21st century. So, could there be a judgment of that actual city of Babylon today? No, there's nothing there. And there wasn't then either. So this obviously is referring to Babylon in a figurative or symbolic manner. Which then means if we're going to understand this, where do we have to go? We got in which part of it? We got to go back to the Old Testament, that's right. So why don't we do that? And we'll see what he says about this Babylon, what was going to happen to it, and why. All right, let's go to Isaiah chapter 13. I think I mentioned some of the references, some of these chapters that were in, especially in the major prophets, Isaiah and Jeremiah most especially, that deals with the coming judgment of Babylon. Well, Isaiah, I know this, we're going to take a little bit of a side path, or go down the side path for a moment, before we get back to the main highway here. But when we're going back to the Old Testament with these prophets, it may help us to kind of roughly keep in mind when they did their work. Because we might think of the major prophets as a group. I mean, they're referred to as a group. Isaiah, Jeremiah, and the book of Lamentations, which was inspired through Jeremiah. And Ezekiel and Daniel. All right, well, that's four major prophets. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. Were they contemporaries? Were they at the same place at the same time? Now, three of those four were prophet, did their lifespans and their work did have overlap. But they had a different purpose that God was using them for. Which three of those four were alive at the same time? Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. But they were in different locations and had a different purpose. Where was Jeremiah? He was in Jerusalem. He was in Jerusalem prophesying of the destruction of the city and what was coming even before the captives were taken into Babylon. And, of course, it was Jeremiah himself in chapter 24 of that book of Jeremiah that had the vision of the two baskets of figs. And so God grouped the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem, well, where were the rest of the Jews at that point? Why don't we, this is a good opportunity to tie together Sunday morning and Wednesday night. Because on Sunday morning right now, we've studied David, and we've looked at Saul, David, and now we're looking at the reign of King Solomon. those three kings, those first three kings of Israel, we can consider them in a group because they're the only three kings. What was unique about them? The only ones that what? Yes, only ones that ruled over all 12 tribes. Because after Solomon, as punishment for Solomon, for his idolatry that he went into, as his heart was turned away from the Lord by his all those foreign women that he married, those princesses, so God brought punishment on him that he separated the kingdom. But he didn't do it in Solomon's days. He did it after his death, when his son became king. But for David's sake, because he promised David to have a ruler on his throne, so God did not take all the tribes away. So the kingdom was divided. And you had 10 tribes that went with whom? Who became their king?
Jeroboam,
the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. It's kind of hard to even say his name without finishing it out with the rest of the sentence. because that's almost all the statements about him in the Bible from when it originally describes all the sins that he led those 10 tribes in the north into. So that was the northern kingdom. It was referred to as Israel because it had 10 tribes. And then you had Rehoboam that ruled over Judah, and he was also given Benjamin. So there was a split there. Well, Jeroboam is the one. You know, when the kingdom first split, the people in the northern kingdom, they kept going down to Jerusalem because that's where the temple was that we've just been studying about it being built. They were going down there by God's commandment three times a year for the feast days. Jeroboam didn't like that. And he worried that if all the people keep going down there to Rehoboam's own capital three times a year, that eventually they're going to just decide to follow him as their king, which he had no reason to be concerned about that because God promised him if he obeyed his commandments like David did, he would make his kingdom sure like David. So he had God's promise that wouldn't happen. He didn't believe it. So then he decided to keep his people from going down to Jerusalem anymore. So he made two golden calves, and he put one in Dan, which is at the very top there, and Bethel, which was the southernmost portion of his territory, tribal territories of those 10 tribes. Put one at each end of his kingdom, and said, "These be your gods, O Israel, which brought you out of Egypt." So he told them they would worship those golden calves instead of going to Jerusalem to the temple anymore. And they did that, and he made up his own priests, he made up his own feast days, his own altar, and all of that. And so he created an entirely new religion for his nation. And that's why it says, from that point onward, every successor, everyone that ruled over those 10 tribes in the north, none of them ever got rid of that, those sins. So they all followed in the steps of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. And that's what it says over and over again for the next 18 rulers after him. So he was one, the first of 19 kings over that divided kingdom. And so what ended up happening? Well, because of that wickedness, God brought that kingdom to an end and sent them into captivity to Assyria. And there was a little bit that didn't happen all at once, but very close, within a few years, but the city of Samaria, the capital city of that northern kingdom, was besieged by the Assyrians and it fell. And so the last of those people in the northern kingdom of Israel were taken into captivity. And all of those people were taken away and they never returned. And they were lost to history. They're called the lost tribes of Israel because they never came back. They just assimilated into wherever they were taken and lost their identity. They already lost their spiritual identity. So they lost their physical identity after that. But does anybody remember what year that was? 722 B.C. Okay. Isaiah, he started his work as a prophet during the time right before that happened. So it was before the fall of the northern kingdom. So he was quite before Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. Jeremiah, all that was left here was Judah and Jerusalem after 722 B.C. So they were on their own for over 100 years. And then didn't learn anything. And actually, not only followed in the footsteps of their sister, but even did worse. And so they got their judgment and went into Babylon. Well, only the good figs went there, which was a remnant. The majority, that's what Jeremiah 24 is about. Two baskets of figs. There were the evil figs, the rotten ones, and then the good ones. The good ones are the ones he took to Babylon. The remnant, they were the small portion of the whole population. So most of all of the tribes were gone, if you consider all of them together, the ones that went to Assyria. And the sword, famine, and pestilence consumed the rotten figs, which was the majority of the population. Jeremiah mostly prophesied to them because he was in Jerusalem, although he started before the captivity when God separated the good figs, the ones that he brought ultimately to repentance, even though that was hard work. And who was the one among them in Babylon when they went there and whose job it was to work on that remnant? That was Ezekiel. So Jeremiah's work was in Jerusalem, mostly with the rotten figs. Ezekiel was with the good figs in Babylon, in captivity. Daniel was also in Babylon, but his work was not among God's people. Where was his work? In the palace with the rulers. He was of the royal seed, and he was in the king's own palace. So he served Nebuchadnezzar. And he served all the way down through Belshazzar, the last of the emperors of Babylon, and then served the Persians after they took over with Cyrus the Great. And he served them. So he was one of the top leaders in the kingdom that ruled at that time, Babylon and Persia. So God had Daniel's work to be with the rulers. So it's interesting that God had all three of them, but in different places with different purposes. But anyway, this ties in here because Isaiah, even back in this time, prophesied of the destruction of Babylon. Well, this was at a time when Babylon had not really risen to any great prominence. It was on the rise, but it was not anywhere close at that point. To where it would be. In fact, Babylon achieved its status under Nebuchadnezzar in the year 605 B.C. That's when the Battle of Carchemish occurred, when Babylon defeated the Egyptians. So there was a great battle there, because the real power and until that point, I mean, the greatest power in that part of the world in that time was Egypt. Well, it had been Assyria, but then Egypt was assuming the mantle. And so Egypt was on the rise, and actually all that was together. Nebuchadnezzar put all of that down in 605 B.C. So that was really the end of the dominance of Egypt and Assyria. And so Babylon assumed the position of the world power at that point. And then became, from then on, was a great plague to Jerusalem and Judah, and took them captive and destroyed Jerusalem. Now, when did that happen? So when did Judah and Jerusalem fall? Well, the destruction of Jerusalem occurred in 586 B.C., and that's when the temple was destroyed. So if you look at that, I mean, between when the northern kingdom went into captivity in Assyria and the final destruction of Jerusalem, I mean, that was 136 years in between. Isaiah was prophesying back then, so he was over 100 years before Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel were doing their work. So Isaiah was much earlier. But he was prophesying well before Babylon rose. His work starting around 700 B.C., I mean, 100 years before Babylon even became what it was under Nebuchadnezzar. And then way before its actual fall and destruction. If you like numbers, like I know I'm kind of nerdy, but I like numbers. But anyway, at 539 BC is when Babylon was conquered by the Persians. So, I mean, if you look at it like that, I mean, Isaiah was, I mean, almost 200 years ahead of these events that he's prophesying about. We are in Isaiah 13 now, right? This does come back to the... I said we would try to get back to the main road, so we're almost getting back to it. But just some of this might help to have a mental picture. I mean, Isaiah prophesied almost a couple of centuries before these events. He's prophesying the destruction of an empire that had not even achieved empire status yet here. I mean, what's significant about that? There's several things significant about it, but what is one of the points there? I mean, how could that be a man? What man right now could foretell 200 years from now? I mean, do we know who's going to be the great power on earth in 200 years? Come on, we have no clue. And we know that. But for this kind of accurate prophecies to be of not only what is the world empire to come at that time, that's not anything like that at this point, and then in detail describe its judgment and destruction. I mean, it's phenomenal. But that's what we have in Isaiah 13. So that's where we are at this point. So that might give at least a little bit to think about as far as a context when we read some of these words here. But let's go ahead and read from Isaiah 13, verses 19 through 22. Let's see, where are we? Is it, Brother Glenn, is it you?
And Babylon, the glory of kings, the beauty of the Chaldees, excellency shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. Neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there, neither shall the shepherds make their fold there. Wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of doleful creatures, and owls shall dwell there, and satyrs shall dance there, and the wild beasts of the islands shall cry in their desolate houses, and dragons in their pleasant places, and her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged.
All right, and just put yourself back in that time if you heard those words. Babylon, the glory of kingdoms. Might anyone have been tempted to say, Babylon, the glory of kingdoms? I mean, Babylon was not the glory of kingdoms when he wrote that. So this is a prophecy of not just its destruction, but of the fact that it was going to become the glory of kingdoms. I mean, it's a prophecy of the whole thing. It's rise and fall. But here's what Jeremiah or Isaiah, of course, by his God, through him, that's telling what's going to happen in the future. Of course, this is one of the characteristics of God that makes him different than any other being. What other being other than God can tell what's going to happen in the future and then make it happen so that it's 100% accurate? He's the only one, which is actually while we're in the book of Jeremiah, I mean Isaiah. Why do I keep doing that? While we're in Isaiah, let's look at what God says about that very point in chapter 46. In verses 9 through 11. And this will actually have relevance to that prophecy we're just reading about in chapter 13 also. 9 through 11 of Isaiah 46. Brother Eric. So there's a specific prophecy of the future, verse 11 there, but verses 9 and 10 establishes the general point about God. that makes him unlike anyone else. He says, I am God and there is none like me. How? In verse 10. Declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will do all my pleasure. That is one of the key ways in which God is different than all others. He can tell you at the beginning what's going to happen at the end, and then he can do it. And it will happen like he says every time. We don't have that kind of power, and there's no other God. So he alone can do that. So when we're reading about prophecy of the future and then it being brought to pass, that's major evidence and proof that this is the Word of God. Now, as it applies to this particular point in verse 11, he gives that general statement in verses 9 and 10. Well, verse 11 is a specific prophecy of a ravenous bird from the east that was going to execute God's counsel from a far country. And God said, I will bring that to pass. Well, who's that ravenous bird from the east that he's talking about? That goes actually back to chapter 45. And he called that ravenous bird from the east by name in verse 1 of chapter 45. And if we had the time, we could go from there into context. Actually, we could go back a few verses up into chapter 44. But we could look at all from the end of 44 all the way through chapter 45 and into chapter 46. And it's one context there in this prophecy. But all this has to do with a man that God was going to raise up that would be the one to destroy Babylon, and did it in 539 B.C. That's the ravenous bird from the east. Who was his name? Well, he first names him in verse 28 of chapter 44. Cyrus. And then names him again in verse 45. There's a lot of prophecy about what he would do concerning the destruction of Babylon. But then, like, if you look, for example, at verse 13, he also says, this Cyrus, he said, I've raised him up in righteousness, and I will direct all his ways, and he shall build my city, and he shall let go my captives, not for price nor reward, saith the Lord of hosts. And so this chapter speaks about how he was going to rebuild the temple. So he was going to send back the remnant, the repentant, those good figs that did repent finally, the ones that Ezekiel was working with, who would be the one to actually give the order for them to return back to Israel and would be responsible for starting the rebuilding of the temple. Cyrus, and he calls him by name. Now this prophecy, keep in mind, this is Isaiah prophesying somewhere back in here now about what was going to happen. So he's calling by name Cyrus, not just some vague ravenous bird from the east, a ravenous bird from the east named Cyrus. Now you talk about specific. Why don't we try pulling that one off? Not just telling who's going to be the great empire 200 years from now, but name the one that's going to destroy it. No way. I mean, just look at that evidence there. That's amazing. But that's what happened. It's interesting when you read Ezra chapter 1, and it says they showed to Ezra what God said about him. Do you think he was shown those words? Well, I mean, it says so. Imagine if you were he and you knew these people that are your captives in your nation, that they have their holy scriptures, and they show, yeah, here's our scrolls, and we've had this for 200 years, and look what it says about you. And you were reading something written 200 years before that called you by name and said exactly what you were going to do. He was impressed by that, obviously, and he said, okay. And he sent them back. He did exactly what they were told to do. That's what the book of Ezra is about. But that ties into this because he was the one that destroyed Babylon. Of course, that occurred, and it's recorded in actual event form in Daniel 5 when the handwriting came on the wall that night for Belshazzar. That's when the kingdom of Babylon came to an end. Well, Cyrus the Great was what he was known as and is known as to history. But that was in 539 B.C. All right, so what was going to happen back in chapter 13? What did he say would happen to Babylon at that time? You remember those verses 19 through 22 that Brother Glenn read? What was going to happen to it? It was going to be destroyed and it would become a dwelling place for whom? Would it be rebuilt? Yep, it would just be a place for the wild animals to dwell. And he said the Arabians aren't even going to pitch their tent there. Well, if we were to actually be able to transport ourselves there right now, what would we say? That. It's still exactly like that. He's describing it in Isaiah. Now, I mean, that's 2,700 years ago. There was a prophecy of exactly what it is even to this day. Phenomenal, isn't it? Well, let's go to the book of Jeremiah. Of course, Jeremiah was much closer in time to it. But when Jeremiah's prophesying of the end of that empire that right now was dominating his own people, that it would be difficult for one to really be able to conceive of the destruction or fall of something that was completely dominant like it was at the time that Jeremiah was making this prophecy, or these ones that we want to look at here briefly. But let's look at Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 39, and see what he foretold about Babylon. We can compare that to what Isaiah prophesied. Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 39. Let's see, Brother Michael, can you read that?
Therefore the wild beasts of the desert and the wild beasts of the island shall dwell there, and owls shall dwell therein, and it shall be no more inhabited forever, neither shall it dwell in from generation to generation.
Alright, this chapter's about that, but do those words sound similar to what we were reading in Isaiah 13? I mean, it's almost exact. It's almost verbatim. Well, let's look at a little more. Chapter 51, verse 26. Brother Ted, you got that? Jeremiah 51, verse 26. Destroyed to an extent, nobody was even going to pick through the rubble and say, I'll build something out of that. I mean, there wasn't even going to be enough of the scrap heap left over that would be worth something to use in a new structure. So they said they're not going to take of your stones and build a foundation out of it, and you'll be desolate forever, saith the Lord. So we could look at several more verses. I mean, there's a bunch of them in Isaiah and Jeremiah about the destruction of Babylon. But it's interesting that while we're in Jeremiah 51 to look at verse 7, what he says in this description of this, the Babylon of old. Jeremiah 51, verse 7, Brother Hugh.
Babylon hath been a golden cup in the Lord's hand, and made all the earth drunken. The nations have drunken of her wine, therefore the nations are mad.
All right, so God used Babylon as a source of punishment for the other nations. And Babylon was also a source of great wickedness that corrupted other nations. And so then God, I know we read chapter 25, a good bit of that not too long ago. Jeremiah 25 has a lengthy prophecy of all those nations and how he was going to use Babylon to make those other nations drink of the cup of God's indignation. And then he was going to make Babylon drink last. And he was going to judge Babylon. So there's prophecy about it in Jeremiah 25 also. Just there's too much of this for us to look at all right now. But, I mean, just looking through some of those, just browsing through some of those statements in Isaiah and Jeremiah, they're consistent. I mean, there was going to be utter destruction. Utter desolation. The place was not going to be rebuilt. And it was going to be God's judgment on Babylon for her wickedness, and also how she had been a source of wickedness to corrupt the other nations. Not just as God's means of judging the other nations, but corrupting them also. And so this is what was going to happen, or what did happen to that actual Babylon. Well, that's what we need to go back to. These are the things that we have to look at and keep in our minds if we're going to understand the reference to of this Babylon the Great in Revelation chapter 17. I mean, we know it's not this physical city that is the subject of these prophecies in Isaiah and Jeremiah, because that was all fulfilled. And in 700 years after, or more than 700 years after Isaiah's prophecies, more than 500 years after Jeremiah's, when Revelation was written, it all been fulfilled, and it was still in the condition that those prophets said it would be in. Utterly desolate, nothing there. And it's still the case, as we've mentioned. But at any rate, God is the one using that as a symbol. So if we're going to really understand his point in Revelation, we need to understand what that's in reference to. So that's what that's about. So going back to Revelation 17. So here's this city that he refers to as the great whore that sits upon many waters. Well, the original Babylon sat upon waters that came in from the Euphrates River. So it's not unusual for a great city to be sitting upon waters. Well, I don't know if we're going to call our city great, but why was Columbia chosen? I mean, it wasn't anything here, really, when it was chosen to be the capital of South Carolina. Columbia is unique. It's one of two so-called planned cities in the United States. Washington, D.C., the national capital, is the other one. So Columbia was unique in along with Washington, of course, as being a state capital. But anyway, Columbia was chosen because it was Charleston originally in colonial times. But anyway, Columbia was chosen to be the capital. See, that's why our city, their downtown is in exact blocks, square blocks and all that. But why was Columbia chosen? What was it about the geography of this area that made it suitable to be the capital city of the state, even before there was a city there here? Yeah, many waters. So we had, you know, you have the Broad River and the Saluda coming together to form the Congaree. So, you know, people talk about Pittsburgh and the three rivers. Well, we got them here too. I know we're not as impressive as Pittsburgh looking, but that's the reason it was chosen. Just a point about the significance of waters to a city, and especially in older times. But anyway. That's not an unusual thing for important cities. And what was the big city in the time of the writing of this book? What was the great city on earth, the great power, and also a source of much wickedness and corruption for the world in this time? Rome. Yes. Well, there. Are there any waters there? So yeah, that would apply there. And that's why a lot of people look at this. Well, this is talking about the ultimate judgment, fall of Rome. Could that be part of this? Well, certainly. I mean, because that would. I mean, there's consistency there with all the elements as far as the source of wickedness in that time. But as we mentioned before, we would not want to try to say, well, this is Rome and that's it. It's exclusively a prophecy of Rome. It certainly could include that. There's lots of elements to this that certainly would fit that. And Rome was judged. Rome did fall. Now, it fell in a different way. It was not conquered. Well, it was destroyed, the physical part of it, by... people that came in from other areas, but it was there was. You might remember when. I know we don't remember. A couple of people here might, but when Rome fell. But that was in what, 486 BC, when the city of Rome fell. I mean, not BC, AD. I'm sorry, we're going to the other side. 486 AD is when Rome fell. But was there the Battle of Rome at the time, a big giant battle, and the Romans lost, and then the conquerors leveled the city? I mean, that's what's happened in all those other cases, really. There wasn't really a battle there in Babylon either, because they got surprised, but the Persians leveled it. But it wasn't a surprise, it wasn't a battle. What happened with Rome is the people had been converted, and they just, there was no battle there because they didn't have any soldiers left, because they beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And so that care for empire and all that sort of thing that had been the important thing to the Romans before, that was gone, because they were no longer, their affection was no longer on this earth, but it was above. And that's exactly what Daniel 2 prophesied about the fall. What was going to be the source of the fall of Rome according to the prophecy in Daniel 2 with that vision that Nebuchadnezzar was given? Remember the iron legs and the feet that were part of iron and part of clay in that image? And what smote that image in the feet? In the days of these kingdoms will God set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, and it would break in pieces and destroy all these kingdoms. That was that great mountain, that stone that was cut out without hands, that destroyed that image and then became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. What is that kingdom? That's the church. So God prophesied of the fall of Rome by the church. Well, was there going to be a Christian army that is like a physical army fighting a battle? No. That's antithetical to what Christianity is about. We're in a spiritual war. So how would they do it? Well, didn't Isaiah also prophesy of the conversion of the people to Christ, what they would do with their weapons of war and all of that? They would turn them into farming instruments. So they weren't going to be fighting anymore. I mean, it's just... what do any of us care about trying to be a world empire? I mean, that's not what we're here for. That's not what we're about. That's not what our mind is on. I mean, that's not what we would do. Well, that's not what they would do anymore either. And so when they weren't doing that anymore, people moved in and filled the vacuum. So if they weren't going to fight for it, then those Goths, I mean, they just walked right in and took it. Rome did fall, and God foretold that, but it was in a different way. It was by gradual conversion of the people. But, certainly at this time, Rome was a source of great evil. But is there anything here that says this is tied to that, and can only be tied to that? I mean, how many different places and different times are mighty on the earth and the source of a lot of evil? This can get very painful for us to think about in our own time. But where does much of the corruption that let me just back up a little bit. When I, 20 years ago, when we were working over in India, India has changed. That's just as one example. It has changed a lot between now, then and now. And I haven't been there in several years, but the Johnsons have been going all the time, and they've been there, you know, consistently through that time. And we've had some plots over there in recent years too, and know what it's like now. But and I've seen the pictures of it and videos and all that. I can see such a difference between when 2002, when I left there, and I saw a lot of change between the 10 years between 1992 and 2002 there. And much of it had to do with the westernization of the country, as you know, you got the they got TV and satellites. You can even see out in these villages. Going to some place, we're going to preach gospel meetings. You go blasting by on a train in these villages, and you see these thatch hut roofs, and some of them had a satellite dish. And I mean, they didn't even have running water in there. I mean, and then it's like, how did that happen? And we started seeing stuff like that, and just, it was, anyway. But you can see with the young people, the change in the way they started dressing, a lot of their customs. So they got all the movies in, they got the internet in there, and then they all, nowadays, they all got cell phones just like we do. And so there's been a huge change in that, but and its effect of their morals. Well, if we're going to be really honest about it, and that's just one example, the same kind of thing is happening worldwide. Which, who's the source of so much of the corruption in this world as far as culture and everything, and morals, and that would be us, I mean, as far as our nation, sadly. I mean, it's really, we got to be honest about it, though, don't we? I mean, that's the truth. It's, we can see the fruits in our own nation, but it's not, we haven't just confined it here. Point being, we see these kinds of things. Well, Paul was a Roman citizen too, right? I mean, he was a citizen of the dominant empire of the day that was also the source of a lot of corruption. But that didn't mean he was in it, but not of it. Well, we're citizens here, and we're in it, but we don't have to be of it, and we can't be. But I mean, we can see that there can be many different times in which there's application of these principles. That's the point. Because we're not just studying, this is not just a history book here. So we're not just looking at, well, this is what God said he was going to do to, this is what God said he was going to do to Rome. Well, it may have had some application then too, but to think it doesn't have application at various points after that, we would be probably making quite a big mistake to think that way. So we want to look for these principles that he's teaching here and what we can learn from it, because as we just read earlier from Hebrews, I mean, what's going to happen to all wickedness? Whether it was in the time of Babylon, whether it was in the time of Jerusalem in Jeremiah's day, whether it was in Roman times, whether it's in our times, what's going to happen? And it doesn't mean it's all going to happen. There's going to be some earthly manifestation of God's judgment. He's done that. Does he still do that? Of course he does. But ultimately, all wickedness is going to be judged by God. I mean, that's really one of the main points of all of this section of Revelation. How much of it has been, that we've been reading in these recent chapters, has been pointing towards the ultimate judgment, what's going to happen in the hereafter. As we have that vision of the followers of Christ who gained the victory over the beast and the false prophet and over his mark and the number of his name, and they're standing on the sea of glass having the harps of God, as he said in chapter 16 or in chapter 14, that they're standing with the Lamb there on Mount Zion, that 144,000. I mean, this is a view of the victory of and the ultimate reward of God's people. But it's not on this earth when that happens. When is our great reward coming? I mean, we have a reward now as we grow in the image of Christ, but the eternal inheritance, that's coming in the future, and that's going to be after Judgment Day. But that day is going to be a day that's going to be very severe for any and all who are wicked. And that's a big point here in Revelation chapter 17. So we've read about the wickedness and the destruction and judgment of that Babylon of old. And so we're seeing that used as a symbol here in Revelation chapter 17 with this figure to Babylon. And this being a city that the kings of the earth have committed fornication with, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. All right, so now as far as that is concerned, there is, of course, physical fornication or adultery. Is there a spiritual sin of adultery as well. Like James 4 and verse 4, when he says, "You adulterers and adulteresses, know you not that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whosoever is a friend of the world is the enemy of God." So what is, and that's also why he granted a bill of divorcement to Judah. In Jeremiah 3, he talks about that. But he divorced his people because they were unfaithful and they had committed adultery against him spiritually when they turned and served other gods. So spiritually, if we're serving anything other than our God, then we're guilty of spiritual adultery. So when he speaks of the fornication that is in filthiness of her fornication here in Revelation 17, is this physical or spiritual or both? Well, you have the beast and the false prophet. One of them, you know, back in chapter 13, and one, of course, was alluring with all of the attraction of the world, and the other, the second beast, is the one referred to as the false prophet with false religion. So what does the Lord use? I mean, what does the devil use to try to destroy men's souls? Whatever he can. And it would be both. I mean, he does use both, and he made that point in chapter 13, and he brought that up again in chapter 17 as the one subject to the pouring out of those seven last plagues. And so now he's focusing that on this Babylon here in chapter 17. But, I mean, we just have to leave open that this could also include false religion as well as physical immorality. Sin in all its forms. But we're going to see that here with this Babylon. All right, so as we read a little bit further here, let's go ahead and... I got plenty of time. It's still 7 after 7. All right, I'm just getting warm. I wish that could be the case, but... all right, well, they're about to pour. And why don't we stop here? We'll pick up in verse 3, Lord willing, next week.